So this afternoon, the teen group had an opportunity to spend time in the forest. Of course, in Thai forest tradition, this is kind of like the bread and butter of our existence, the basics, being able to spend time in the forest, having time of solitude, having time of quiet periods in a natural environment. And it's important to give this to ourselves, because our habits or the tendencies within the culture are usually toward more busyness, more engagement, more distraction. So that to actually very consciously try to step back and rely on an external environment to help support our own intuition that we deeply want something peaceful in our hearts. So to have this time of being in the monastery, being in the forest, it's a very supportive tool to help us. It's also kind of highlighting the opportunity that we have for learning from the environment around us, the circumstances, the contact that we have. It's like years ago when I was living in Thailand, and one of the things that our teacher Ajahn Chah would have us do would be we would spend time in his monastery with him, and he was a very charismatic teacher, but then he would send us out to live in the branch monasteries, out in the countryside, smaller monasteries, and these are real serious backwaters, some of them, so that, nothing happening, and maybe not the most inspiring teacher, and but what happens? You get bored. you get fed up. And one time, one of the Western monks was living out in one of these branch monasteries, and from time to time, Ajahn Chah would usually go around and visit the monastery, see how the different monasteries were doing, see how the monastics living there, how they were doing. And when Ajahn Chah arrived, the Western monk who was there, he'd been there for many months, and he took the opportunity to approach Ajahn Chah and let him know of the difficulties that he was having. And he's saying, I feel I don't have any teachers here. And Ajahn Chah said, you're not paying attention. You've got six teachers and you're not listening to them. And the monk was really confused and said, six teachers? I'm not getting teaching from anything here. And he expressed that sort of frustration, and Ajahn Chah said, your teachers are always with you. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, your mind. These are your teachers. And if you don't learn how to listen to these teachers, then you'll never learn how to be peaceful. You'll never learn how to be at ease wherever you go. So it's a really important standard to reflect on, because we tend to always look to external things for distraction, or for gratification, or for affirmation. And you have to understand how that works and understand what the poles are, but you don't want to be dragged around by them. You want to be able to I've got the resources within myself to learn from my experience. And just that opportunity to be present with the circumstances that we're in, the sense contact that we have, because whatever sense contact we have, it doesn't actually, I think I was talking about it earlier today somehow, in the sense of, oh, it's just this much, not so much. You know, in the sense that whatever it is, you know, it'll be pleasant, it'll be unpleasant, it'll be neutral. Not a big thing. That's not how our mind works, because we don't sort of, oh, this is another pleasant phenomena, this is another unpleasant circumstance. We love the story. We'll do anything for the story. Ajahn Amaro tells about a circumstance. This is many years ago now. Ajahn Amaro was still living in England, in Amaravati. So that'd be maybe late 80s, early 90s. And it was during the time when there still wasn't really a good approach for treating people with AIDS and HIV, or it was still very uncertain. And somebody from New York contacted to the monastery and said, I've contracted AIDS, I'm HIV positive, and I'd really like to live out the rest of whatever life is left in a skillful way, in a peaceful environment. Could I live at the monastery? So they invited him to come, staying at the monastery, and he would go in to London from time to time. He had a doctor that was there, and of course the community knew, and he was very open about it, and everything was around supporting this person who had a life-threatening illness, probably dying with this disease. So then, checking in with the doctors, he had a good doctors in London, and from time to time he would go in, get checkups, get tested. And then one day he came back from the doctors and was sitting in the hall, and he looked really just crestfallen and really shattered. And Ajahn Amaro saw him, and he came up to him and asked him, you know, what's wrong? How are you? And he said, well, I've been having some real thorough set of tests lately, and I've got all the results back, and I don't have AIDS. And I said, well, what is it? He said, well, it's a very rare blood disorder. And then I said, well, can it be treated? He said, oh yes, there's actually a fairly simple treatment. And Ajahn Amaro said, well, isn't that good news? I said, yeah, but I lost my story. which is really interesting. Because, yeah, how much of our, even something that is, you know, really something that one would never, you'd think you'd never wish for, or you'd think you wouldn't ever want. But then, you know, you create a story, and the story has more life than the possibilities. Yeah. So it's an interesting reflection to say, okay, what's the story that's going on with the particular pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral sensations, contacts, moods, thoughts that I'm experiencing? And it's a worthy investigation, because the tendency is, you know, it depends on our temperament, of course, you know, to pay attention to what the proliferation is. There's a teaching that the Buddha gave, and it's in response to one of the great disciples of the Buddha, Anuruddha. He was actually one of the Buddha's cousins. He's a incredible meditator and was renowned for his refined meditation. And one time he was meditating in the forest and reflecting on the characteristics of a great being. And of course, I can't think of what they are right now, but you know, the things, okay, somebody with, you know, energy, mindfulness, discernment, compassion. And there were seven qualities. And the Buddha approved of those qualities, but he said there should be one more to the list of, I mean, when we're thinking of the characteristics and qualities of a great being, the last quality should really be one who delights in non-complication. And that's the non-complication or non-proliferation. And that's a really important quality, you know, that sense of, oh yeah, somebody who really understands themselves, understands the world around them, has that capacity to not make things too complicated, get too spun out over anything. And that's incredible refuge. So it's a really great reminder for all of us as practitioners. It's something to work towards or to set up as a goal to try to establish. So that delighting in non-complication, non-proliferation. Again, this aspect of thinking of that non-complication, non-proliferation, is just when we're developing our meditation, our application of the Buddha's teachings in our daily life. And I mentioned in the meditation instruction, just learning how to enjoy the practice, enjoy being mindful, enjoy being present. Because there is a naturalness to this practice. I mean, obviously effort is required, but it isn't a kind of striving and pushing effort. It's the effort that comes from, like when you enjoy doing something, you don't have a problem with putting forth effort at it. Was it like, Alex was doing some sort of acrobatics bit just after tea time. And that's something that he obviously enjoys, but it's something that you've got to put effort into. But when it's something that one enjoys, then the effort is actually, the effort is enjoyable. So trying to approach the training of the mind in a similar way, where one sees the benefits and sees the advantage of having a peaceful mind, when seeing the advantage of having a kind of a solid center of awareness within oneself. And then there's this kind of enjoyment that is quite natural. And then the actual path of practice starts to unfold on its own. The image that the Buddha gave, he said it's like when rain falls on the mountaintop, then as the rain falls on the mountaintop, then the rain comes down and it comes in, begins in little rivulets, and then it gathers into small little streams, and then the streams come together into creeks, and the creeks flow into the rivers, then the rivers flow into the ocean. And it's a natural process. And the Buddha points to that similar natural process of how when we develop a sense of virtue and integrity, it's natural that we have a sense of well-being. That's a natural result. And when we have a feeling of that sense of well-being, arising through that virtue, integrity, then there's a sense of tranquility. It's quite natural that a sense of tranquility arises from well-being. And then from this quality of tranquility, it's quite natural that there's joy arising. And with joy arising, it's quite natural that there's happiness. In the Buddha's language, the word for joy is more like a mental, emotional joy, and happiness is both the sense of the body being suffused with that joy, but then that kind of sense of satisfaction that comes, that one feels very physically. And said, when with happiness, it's quite natural that the mind becomes settled and firm. And the word that is samadhi, which is usually what people translate as meditation. That meditative stillness, meditative stability, has these causes and conditions. And it's quite natural one thing leads to another. In the same way as that, you know, when the rain falls on the mountaintop, it's natural that it flows down and it gathers into larger and larger streams of water until it finally, you know, flows out the ocean. I mean, it's like here where this is actually the beginning of the Russian River down at the hills over there, and the creek that goes in front of the monastery is a tributary of the Russian River. It flows out and it goes out to just north of Santa Rosa and heads out to the ocean. So that it's natural that's how it works. So that we begin with this practice and training of restraint of our body and speech, so that we're within a boundary of integrity and a sense of, we're really what's right, what's appropriate. And then these aspects of well-being and increasing settledness of mind lead to the mind becoming peaceful and settled. That meditative stability naturally leads to clarity. It's natural. And the quality that the Buddha points to that arises is this. The idiom that's used is knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. It's just that clarity of just seeing, oh, this is how it works. This is what it's like in nature. This is the natural order of things. And that's what Dhamma is, actually. It's just the natural order of things. So that when we accord with the natural order of things, there's no conflict, there's no difficulty. There's no complication. So that even though it's natural, one has to accord with what is natural also. So that's where we need awareness. That's where we need mindfulness. So that we can actually tune in. And that's, say, the word that is usually translated as wisdom is probably better translated as discernment. Where we discern clearly how things work, discerning, seeing clearly, and just having that discernment that's able to distinguish, this is what's going to lead to well-being, and this is what's going to lead to more complication. So that seeing that clearly, when you see that clearly, I mean, what choice do you make? I mean, there's actually no choice. In the sense that really deep down we much prefer to be happy rather than to be miserable. we much prefer to be peaceful rather than sort of agitated and all over the map. It's just as natural when we tune in. So that sense of paying attention, developing a discernment, but of course that developing of discernment doesn't arise just because of wishful thinking. And there's a path, there's a training, there's a way of implementing aspects of of training, of development, so that we can see clearly. And that's what when the Buddha points to the Noble Eightfold Path as the way leading to the end of suffering, that's the path of training. Beginning with right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, or right meditation. Those are the eight aspects of training our body, speech, and mind. And when you put it like that, especially in the English language, then we're primed to make certain assumptions. Like when you say right view, right thought, right speech, then we're kind of primed to think, well, I've got to get it right. And if I don't get it right, then I'm wrong. And if I get it wrong, then that's bad. But it's important to recognize that the language that the Buddha uses is a bit more nuanced, so that the word that the Buddha uses that's been translated as right, and I don't know that there's a better translation, but it's helpful to understand the language sometimes, or the roots of things, because the word that's that when you say right, right view or right thought, through all of the aspects of the Eightfold Path, the word that's used is actually a musical term that the Buddha used to apply to this, so that when we're thinking right, it's more like right in tune, or sort of just right, so that it harmonizes. And that's, of course, that's a whole different feeling when you think about, okay, how do I harmonize my actions of body, speech, and mind? How do I harmonize the view and thought so that they accord with the speech and action? How do I harmonize the speech so that it fits in with the intentions that I have? And that's really interesting. It's a very different way of holding it. And then, of course, then it's where, okay, I need to be mindful. I need to investigate. I have to trust in some of the experience, because we gain experience and we learn as we go along, as we try different things out. But the whole aspect of learning how to get something so that it's in tune, that it's harmonizing, or that it's just right. And the just right quality, the natural result from that, is a sense of well-being. It's sort of like when you're chanting, I mean, here we don't sing, but when you're chanting, if somebody's out of tune, you can really hear it. And similarly, if anybody, if you're singing or whatever, and there's scope for a different range of voices, there's scope for slightly different pitches, but if they're in tune, they work together, they harmonize. But if it doesn't, then it really grates. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in our practice. So that learning how to tune in and try to pay attention. Is it harmonizing? Is these things fitting in? And it's a lot of it is that, again, this that mindfulness, awareness, tuning in. When I was growing up, my mother used to bug her when I would try to sing something, because I can always hear her painful voice. you're not listening. So that's it. But you know, there's the radio's on or something, there's a record player on, singing along with it and just missing it completely. And as my mother was a singer, she enjoyed singing, she was part of choral groups, and that was just, you're not listening. Of course, that was the story of my growing up, and I left home and became a monk over in Thailand, and finally when my parents came to visit, I'd been a monk for about 8 years then, so I'd been away for, I don't know, over 9 years. So she hadn't seen me for all that time, and met them down in Bangkok, and they witnessed a meal offering. There was two of us, two monks, and then we gave the blessing after, and that really impressed her. I said, oh, he must be doing something right, because he can actually harmonize with this other monk. The other thing that really impressed her was when the food, various food was offered, put it in the bowl, put it in the bowl, put it in the bowl. You know, everything's put in the one bowl. And after giving the blessing, she couldn't restrain herself anymore. She had to come and take a look inside my bowl. Because when I was growing up, I was an incredibly fussy eater. And you know, things couldn't touch each other. And and I couldn't mix things, and I hated that. And like, I remember, you know, going off to work in different places or going to university and sharing an apartment. I'd do all the cooking because I didn't like what other people did. But then my mom, seeing, wow, food, he's not so fussy about food anymore, and he can actually harmonize. He's learning something. This is real. It is a real concrete benefit to meditation or practice. So that sense of harmony, and we take that to these different aspects of how we apply that, and that result of really tuning in and being able to listen to our actions of body, speech, and mind. Really learn from the sense contact around us. This is the foundations of Buddhist practice, and it's something that we all can learn, we can all practice, we can all taste the fruits of. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.